Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about a really interesting project. Our UW-Madison researchers are working on a project to bank the DNA of species in order to save them. And we're talking about the leader of that project. It's just getting underway, by the way. And our guest, Francisco Pellegrini, is a professor of genetics. He's also chair of the UW-Madison Genetics Department in the UW College of Ag and Life Sciences, and is the leader for the UW Biobank Project. We're going to talk with him about that project and about the challenges and also the ethical considerations that go into bioconservation through genetic storage. There's lots to talk about here. And I hope you'll join in as we move through the program today for this hour. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Francisco Pellegrini, welcome. Thanks for being in the studio with me today.
No, thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Let's start by talking about the threats to extinction. I think worldwide, do we even know how many species are under threat?
Oh, right now there's We are at the verge of essentially the rates of extinction are in the span of the next 500 years are predicted to be equal to that of a mass extinction. So it would be the sixth mass extinction, which is essentially 75% of all species. So if you take all species that are endangered or threatened, what you'd call the vulnerable categories, and assume they're not rescued, we literally are at the rates of mass extinction. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of species. If we think vertebrates alone, there's 66,000 species, so the 75%. And the larger animals are also, like vertebrates, for example, would be also more vulnerable.
I'm thinking about your research, which is zeroing in on the Great Lakes region, including Wisconsin, of course, and the number of species that just exist in this region. There's got to be, over 1,000 species just in the water alone.
Oh, yeah. I'm not an ecologist. Of course, Wisconsin has many species, which is one of the nice things about thinking about having this project here in Wisconsin. It's also not as complex as, say, the rainforest, right? So one of the ideas of that we are exploring is having a proof of principle model for biopreservation, mm-hmm. which could be at the ecosystem level, basically using land-based ethics, as opposed to, say, this or that species or that animal because it's attractive or because it calls to us. It's rather used a land-based ethics. And so that's why having a location and trying to preserve the actual ecosystem, that location, makes sense. Because then we target everybody and the network, which is essentially what works, is the network.
Yeah. So what works, you can come up with something that works in the Great Lakes region. Hopefully that same process could be applied to other areas.
Exactly. That's right. So one advantage of working in the Great Lakes region is that there is a lot of biodiversity, but there's also it's not as much as another place like a rainforest. And so we could establish a pipeline to show how you could do it in specific locations, right? In an enclosed system. You could say the same about an island like Madagascar or even the Catalina Island, right? Something mm-hmm. small. Isle Royale, anything that you can say you can safeguard the ecosystem, and in its entirety becomes a model.
It makes a whole lot of sense. And your project would preserve the DNA of as many species as possible.
Right. Yeah. So if you think about ecosystem level, it's of course, it's extremely challenging, but the idea is to preserve species in a way that is systematic at large scale. a scale that will be valuable, because small scale is not valuable in terms of genetic preservation. And when we talk about DNA, by the way, we're talking about the entire genome. And as it is right now, with the technology that we have, we can sequence DNA, but we really, with the sequence, we, as of now, we cannot, and for a few decades, we will not be able to make cells out of it. So we really are talking about preserving cells, because the cells are what has the DNA. You don't have to change it. It has it. You can even reconstitute a cell with a freeze-dried nucleus, and it works. Right. So what we're talking about when we talk about DNA preservation, we're actually talking about cell sampling at large scale.
So, as I was thinking about this, I have done a little reading on this. It's one of the reasons that the University of Wisconsin can become involved in something like this is that we have a broad range of talents that can be brought to bear. And that's probably, maybe you can talk about that as your project leader of this, kind of yours and others' ideas. Talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. Wisconsin's a great place for starters, with a philosophy of the Wisconsin idea. And yep. Also many environmentalists have come from Wisconsin. And then we have a tremendous expertise on campus that goes from ecology to animal reproduction to communication science and ethics. Right now we have, for example, a grant that's funded by NSF on the responsible use of new technologies. That the principal investigator of that grant, by the way, is Paul Robbins, who's the director of the NELSON, who's leading that overarching effort. And so we have really, and the approach that we're going to talk about is extremely interdisciplinary. So we have all that expertise all the way to stem cell technology, like Jamie Thompson, who was here at Madison. All those technologies, together with animal science, vet science, all that can be integrated into a management pipeline for species preservation and preservation of their health. In a sense, biodiversity is the way that species, and we can talk a lot more about this, is the way that species remain healthy.
Yeah. I was even thinking of Bill Murphy, William Murphy, mm-hmm. as another example. There we go to biomedical engineering. I think he is professor there.
Yeah. Bill Murphy was actually, so we had an interdisciplinary grant from UW-Madison, and Bill Murphy was, in fact, he was the first person that wanted to be in that grant. And so he was he is a collaborator in this project also. He works on biopreservation with mineralized materials. And I think the idea is that this is, if we are going to biopreserve cells, we may need them decades later, and so we need very, very efficient ways in which those cells are going to last those decades. And it's now we're talking about social, economical, political challenges to having those. Having something that's extremely efficient is very helpful. So, for example, keeping cell lines encapsulated in mineralized material, which is what Bill Murphy has pioneered for vaccines and other things, for mRNA, but it can also be done in cell lines, would be a way to have cells at room temperature as opposed to liquid nitrogen, right? So then reduce the carbon footprint, it reduce the cost. Because a lot of these cell lines may be needed 100 years from now, and we won't know that they're needed until they really are needed. So we really need to be efficient and smart about how to do this.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was remembering a story. I mean, there's sub-zero freezers that you find in labs and so forth. Things can happen.
Oh, yeah. Sure, yeah. There's a colleague of mine, Tony Goldberg, at the vet school, and he has a rule that there's every 3 years there's a freezer disaster. So liquid nitrogen is much more is much better, more stable. We were visiting the San Diego Zoo, which has liquid nitrogen tanks, and they have a way that if there's a power loss, essentially everything gets shut down, and I think it lasts frozen. The entire room gets shut down and sealed, and then the samples can last for a week or two. preserved without power.
Yeah. I do remember a story about a California lab that somebody turned off the wrong switch and turned off the freezers or whatever they were, and they lost 25 years of research.
Sure. Yeah, you know, biopreservation is really important. Like if you think about the Svalbard plant seed bank, right? That's in an island north of Norway, right? And that they're using the cold, the natural cold, so for preservation. I've even seen thought about this myself, but I've even seen an article proposing the moon as a place to put samples, right? Just because it would be free cold, essentially.
Oh, I hadn't thought about this.
Yeah.
Well, how far along are you on this now?
We just starting. We are. The idea that samples are important started in the 70s, 80s. San Diego Zoo was one of the pioneers on this.
Yeah.
We're just at the point where some of those samples that were frozen 40 years ago are coming back to us to help the populations, like with the black-footed ferret. This sample that had been frozen for 40 years, that sample had three times more genetic diversity than the existing black-footed ferret, so it's really important to reinvigorize the population. So we're getting to the point where we are starting to understand the importance of that approach. At the time, samples were frozen because the species was near extinction, but we are getting to the point where we understand that, first of all, any species can become extinct, no matter what the size. Yeah. The passenger pigeon is a great example, right?
Yeah.
There were billions in the sky, and they became extinct. And so we understand we also need a lot more samples. There's a minimum number of samples you want to have, or a minimum number of genetic diversity represented in those samples that you want to have a healthy population. So we're talking about thousands of samples. And so now we kind of go, we get to the point where we're proactively thinking that we need to be proactive and that we also are able to amass large groups, interdisciplinary groups that accept that technology. Technology has also has some detractors, understandably. And so we get into the point where we have that momentum. At the moment, we had we were hoping we can biopreserve Wisconsin as a model for essentially a model landscape. We would start with the higher trophic levels going down, and at some point, of course, it becomes a matter of having the land mass. That's the idea. Right now, we have a grant, a pilot from NSF, as I mentioned, and in the grant, we are proposing to do biopreservation of samples from the red fox and from American marten. So we have David Drake, who's in the show. He's as a collaborator in this. And so we are hoping to get 15 samples from each of those species and then just pull them. We'll have a pipeline where we know which sample is which. We know how much genetic diversity is in the sample. Genetic diversity is important because it takes 15 samples from a beehive that is in the same area, or bees from the entire state represents a very different, an extreme example, right? So you need to assess the genetic diversity in the sample. Then they will be frozen as pools, and then we want to thaw them back out and re-identify and know we got them. We froze them in a 50-fold efficient, for example, manner, and then we can get them back, right? And so the idea would be, can we biopreserve diversity in sort of aliquots? An aliquot is sort of like a small tube. When you have a large volume, you don't want to freeze them all. You store them in small tubes you can use. And the nice thing about cell lines is that once you get them, they can also reproduce themselves. So, for example, you can get a small piece of skin and get fibroblasts, they're called. And there's cells that grow from skin very easily. They can grow multiple passages, they can also be turned at some point into stem cells and induced pluripotent cells. And those can grow forever. So you could make these aliquots, let's just say 1,000 samples in aliquots of 50. You could use one, but you could regrow it and just put it back in the freezer, essentially. So, and then the idea is, maybe we're getting a little bit ahead, but the idea is that as you monitor biodiversity, if it's needed, let's just say a very large wildfire and there was a large loss of animal life, if you notice, or an individual species, there's a loss in genetic diversity, you could reintroduce that genetic diversity with the genetic diversity in those samples.
Oh, interesting. Our guest today, Francisco Pellegri, professor of genetics, chair of the UW-Madison Genetics Department in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, and a leader of the UW project. It's the Biobank Project. I almost forgot the title of it, the UW Biobank Project, and we're getting into it now. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along here about the work being done and talking about DNA and preserving it and banking it. Should we be doing that? Some people might argue against it, but I think there are some really good reasons for doing this work. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the UW Biobank Project, where we are UW researchers are studying the Great Lakes region, and they are the goal is to collect the DNA from as many animals as we can come up with, as we can find, to be able to regenerate that species in the future. And we're talking about how that all is working with our guest, Francisco Pellegri, who is leader of the project. And again, join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Daniel emailed, how are the DNA samples actually collected? Blood, hair, tissue, or does it vary based on different animals?
Great question. Yeah, thanks. So the in the older days, biobanking of animal species in the wild used to be thought of as involving gametes. And we're talking about sperm, like freezing sperm from any animal, or eggs. But as you can imagine, this is pretty... it's much more involved, if not very highly invasive. The first time I talked to a person, it was a person in Belize, and that's what they were doing with frogs. That seems very invasive, which is something you don't want to do with a large scale, especially with an endangered species or threatened species. So that the one thing that has been transformative is the ability to reprogram cells now into stem cells, so with induced pluripotent cells, which has come in the last couple of decades. So which means that you can take any sample and reprogram it into a stem cell. So this could be it could be a piece of a small biopunching skin. It could be a little bit of blood. It could also be hair follicles, cells around a hair, hair follicles, or around the follicles of feathers. Mm. You can even get cells out of the lining, the intestinal lining in feces, has cells from the host that you can sequence and actually isolate, or even saliva. So there's many, many ways, and it could be, as you say, species specific. For some species, in certain ways may be better than others. Right now, one way that is helpful, and that's where our foxes, Red Fox and American Marten Project is going in, is to partner with people who will be monitoring the animal anyway and handling the animal anyway, and then getting a very small sample. So, for example, what we're trying to do is getting a very small 4 millimeters. So 4 millimeters is a very tiny amount.
Very tiny.
Very tiny, and literally at the tip of the ear, so that it would be scarless. Right? And so, but that would still allow us, and we have collaborators, this laboratory, the SUSY sample in the vet school, who can get fibroblast cell lines out of that small amount. And those fibroblast cell lines can be frozen, they can be analyzed for DNAs, they can be stored, they can be pooled, they can be turned into stem cells. And they can be used for to generate an animal. A stem cell can be used either for cloning or to make germ cells and put back into an animal and make gametes again. So that's really the transformational aspect, is the ability to make stem cells right now, which is what scientists in the field worldwide are trying to push for this approach, which really has changed the landscape. It allows us to do it large scale, also without affecting the individuals. You could get just like one of those a tiger in Siberia, you could get just hairs that get caught in like one of these places next to a tree that catches the hair, and then you could, might be able to get cells out of that. So there's very different ways that we're exploring, even potentially DNA or cells in mosquitoes, right? I mean, there's all kinds of ways you could try to get cells.
I was thinking about this. Getting the broad diversity, really, I mean, once you get down to the fact, let's take the white rhino, for example, mm-hmm. of which there's only a handful left in the right. world, now we're getting down to the point, all right, I think there's even some work going on to clone white rhinos. But the problem with that is that the few are the, there's no diversity there.
Right, exactly. This is what this is what attracted my attention was the story to this topic, because I'm a developmental biologist by training, always interested in conservation. But there was this attempt in the early 2000s to clone an Iberian, a Pyrenean ibex, which had become extinct. And of course, by the time, and there was an attempt of trying to clone it, the clone didn't survive, but it's really what really highlighted is the species had been protected in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. They still could not make it. This is because there's something that happens called the extinction vortex, which is basically that as you are, if you're healthy, you are outside of the vortex, the population mm-hmm. is healthy in terms of genetic diversity, you're outside of the vortex. But as soon as you start having issues like inbreeding, and this could be caused by fragmentation, right, you can have lots of animals, but they're fragmented. So effectively, the populations are very, very small. Inbreeding and other, it just adds up. And then the populations essentially get sucked into extinction. And so
And it doesn't take very many generations for that to occur, or two or three.
It essentially probably amplifies, right? So at some point, animals are thought to be as functionally extinct. So we were talking about the rhinos. There is the southern white rhinos, they came back from very small numbers. So that's a success story. And presumably the small number of southern white rhinos had enough genetic diversity to now have a reinvigorated healthy population now. But the northern white rhinos could not. And what they have for the northern white rhinos at the San Diego Zoo is, and collaborators, is sperm and eggs and oocytes that are frozen. And what they're thinking is to use those and use the related species, the southern white rhino, as a foster mother for those embryos to allow them to survive. Now, having said that, yes, you are. What we don't want to be in the situation where you have so few samples that even if you get those individuals back, they won't survive again, right? So this is where the concept of having very large samples in the first place comes into play, because then we're not talking about bringing an animal back from extinction when we're talking about biopreservation in a future genetic management strategy. We're talking about monitoring genetic diversity and on way, way before they become threatened, actually reinvigorating the population if needed, precisely for that problem.
Yeah, and so it's hard to almost wrap your mind around it, because you're looking at all these species, thousands of species, really, and is broad, getting as broad a range of variants as possible among those. And somebody's going to say, well, why are you collecting 1,000 samples of a water flea? What the heck is the good of that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Well, I think when it gets down to water flea or mosquitoes, it starts to be a little more complicated to argue. But generally, the ecosystem is all interconnected, right? So you can very there is data to back up the idea that by helping one species, you help many species by reinforcing the ecosystem. Ecosystems depend on a large network, and the more varied the network, the stronger the ecosystem is, the ecosystem network. And so we're not just talking about one species, we're talking about the entire ecosystem when we help one species.
You're working with Paul Robbins, and you mentioned Paul's name earlier. He's dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. What has the working with him changed the focus of your project, or has it changed the focus?
Yeah, I think when we first, so Paul had attended some workshops on the use of new technologies for grand challenges, and so he was interested in this approach. And when we first started meeting, the whole concept, for as a big example, is the whole concept of prioritization of species. Why do you choose one species as opposed to another? Why choose a panda as opposed to a gastric frog, right? How do you prioritize species that you target? And so that was a big question, is what is the rationale, the ethics and the rationale for prioritization, right? Because these are going to be efforts. And then at the time, I was just thinking about the technique. I was thinking the technique that we're essentially working with, in particular in my lab, is yes, we're working outside of the lab to try to get samples, but we're also working, once you have those samples, you need surrogates for the samples to become gametes and individuals. And the surrogates could be a captive population, mm-hmm. or it could be a different species. Yeah. So anyway, I'm telling Paul Robbins, as far as I know, the technique works with related species because they're related enough to be surrogates. Mm-hmm. And so then the idea of somehow it came out, the concept that a location like Madagascar, for example, where all the animals are related 60 million years ago because of the geology, that would be a good model system. And so then the concept of land ethics is what became the rationale for prioritization. And that came from out of that conversation. And then the other thing that I've gotten a lot from my interactions with Paul Robbins is the emphasis on indigenous sovereignty, so that we have we're engaged. Any effort, any biopreservation effort is engaged with sovereignty of indigenous nations, and that's also something that we're working that he's leading.
Yeah, it's all kind of Aldo Leopold ethic.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Comes into play mm-hmm. here,
right?
Well, it's we could probably talk some more about tribal concerns. I was thinking about, I read somewhere, I can't remember where now, but the biodiversity of lands that are owned by or managed by native indigenous populations, mm-hmm. it's like 80% of all right. of the of what we have.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of diversity.
That's right. I think globally about 70 to 80% of biodiversity is in local indigenous lands. Yeah.
It certainly makes a lot of sense then to be working with our indigenous populations for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Our guest today, Francisco Pellegri, we're talking about the bio project, the biobank project, I should say, that's the UW is working on right now. Just sort of it's in its earliest stages, I guess we should say. Francisco Pellegri is the leader of that project. And questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Louise in Dodgeville, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. In regards to the Great Lakes or Midwest region, I was wondering what your guests considered maybe like foundational or keystone species. Like I know oak trees are kind of a keystone of the ecosystem, and sturgeon are, eons old. So in terms of collecting DNA and prioritizing, would there be a focus in the Midwest?
Yeah,
great question. So the concept of biopreservation has been long established with plants, and in a sense, we're trying to recreate and then gain acceptance and momentum for the animal biopreservation. So in terms of animals, there are our pipeline, one thing that we're interested in is to set up a pipeline for the entire ecosystem. So the pipeline doesn't necessarily depend on threatened species. In a sense, it's almost better to establish a pipeline with species that are not as threatened, just because they'll be easier access and so on. So that's why red foxes, American martens, although those are crucial in terms of conservation as well, but those are part of our pipelines. In terms of animal targets that are easy to think about in terms of threatened status, we do have a number of species in the Midwest, in the Great Lakes, like the rusty patch bumblebee, which is critically endangered, the Carner blue butterfly, which is endangered. The butterfly is interesting too because it depends on specific bushes, which is the lupine bush, which really emphasizes that we can't just think about animals; we have to think about the entire ecosystem, including the plants that are related and interdependent. I think you mentioned the sturgeon. There's also a number of turtles, like the wood turtles, Blanding's turtles, whooping crane, of course, with the Crane Foundation doing extremely important work. And so on. There's a number of bird species, curlew warbler, the Great Lakes piping plover, there's a number of bats that are endangered, and so those would be the targets that one would think initially that to prioritize. But at the same time, we are thinking about the entire ecosystem. Any animal could become extinct years from now. This is the time to get the samples when there's a lot of animals. So the easiest projects are the ones that are available are the ones that we should pursue as well. And so, I think it will probably be a combination of prioritization and also, in a sense, going through the various species. Perhaps higher trophic levels going down.
Luis, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. And that habitat, I mean, a lot of species are lost because of a loss of habitat. Should we bring back these animals before restoring the habitat? That's a question.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a question for me, or?
Well, it is a question.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think it makes any sense, right? You need to have the habitat, and this is why it's. I think when we're talking about biopreservation of samples, we have to keep in mind that they will be almost like a joke to have if we have no habitat, right? And the other thing that the approach is, so in a sense, they remind us how important habitats are. The nice thing about this approach is we're not trying to recreate a habitat. We're just trying to keep it so that, again, you monitor genetic diversity of a particular species or a couple of species might be going down, you reintroduce genetic diversity, keeping the habitat healthy. It's not to create a habitat from scratch. It would be very hard, if not impossible. So, so that's there are some species, for example, like the golden toad in Monteverde in Costa Rica, that was the first species that was widely thought of as a victim of climate change loss, and it was quite publicized. There were other aspects like this invasive fungus and so on, but it became endangered in Monteverde, but the habitat is still there. So this is a case where, I know we're not talking about bringing back species, right?
No, that's right.
But this is a case where there is a habitat and the species is not there anymore, right? So clearly habitat is essential. That's what we don't want to do is miss opportunities to have tools that we can help to strengthen ecosystem networks, species health, and habitats.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Costa Rica, of course, and for the past decade, you've led field trips to Costa Rica with your students, which sounds like really interesting, but fun too.
It's super fun. We've done it for a while. We had to stop during COVID, but we're hosted by Organization Tropical Studies. We go to three different ecosystems on spring break, about 20 students from campus, and the ecosystems are rainforest, a cloud forest on the mountains, and then on the other side of the mountains, a dry seasonal marshland. And they really see how the ecosystem can change so much in such a short stretch of geographical stretch, and also the interconnection of even the climate change and how the cloud forest has been affected by that, because just the cloud forest in itself is so dependent on the air currents that are also affected by heat. So they really get to see. The last time we went there, we actually saw an ocelot. I completely flipped out because cats are very hard to see. But we had a student with a huge zoom, and he took the photo. And like, I could not believe that little thing that we were seeing was an ocelot. But we all got to experience, and it's really quite transformational. Some of the students have never even traveled abroad before.
Yeah. I understand. Led some tours myself of students to. Trinidad, and I understand well how transformative that could be. Mm-hmm. Did those trips have any influence or get you thinking along the lines of this project? Tell us.
Sure. Yeah. In many ways, I think one of the initial purposes of the trip was to get collaborators there. So now we know people in Costa Rica, for example. But one thing that, as an example, and we do work in the Great Lakes, but we also have collaborators in Nepal, for example, or mm-hmm. now in Costa Rica, and you could potentially think about the same kind of approaches in those areas with collaborators. And these kinds of even trips that are educational trips are really important to make those connections and also building trust between people and the communities there. But one thing that struck me maybe the last couple of times going to Costa Rica every year we go is how the Costa Rica has this mountain range, and the mountain range has a cloud forest in it. And in a sense, it's really the cloud forest is like an island in land, right?
Yeah.
Which is essentially the animals, if you have climate change, and that's changing the location of the border with the cloud forest, that might be shrinking the geographic mm-hmm. location to the point where they might become the island might go away. So in a sense, it made me realize how this ecosystem was really quite enclosed, and there are a lot of species that are adjusted to that range, that mountain range, and they have nowhere to go. And so in that sense, it's almost like having Madagascar, right, or having another island. Yeah.
Francisco Pellegrini, our guest today, he is leader of the UW Biobank Project. Love to hear from you. I see we have some emails. We'll get to those. And we've got open lines, and you can join in with your question or comment at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Francisco Pellegrini, who is the leader of the UW Biobank Project. He's a professor of genetics and actually chairs the Department of Genetics at the UW-Madison. Again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Before we take these emails, you plan to have your students in Costa Rica collect the DNA of animals from the blood of mosquitoes.
Yeah, so we, right, so this was a project where we wanted to do some sampling. But understandably, local communities, local countries, and they have very strong regulations against just going and taking samples, right?
Sure.
So then we wanted to have a project that would be interesting to students. And it would also be pretty inoffensive in terms of the regulations. And so we came up with this. And mosquitoes are used already they're already used in Africa you can identify what the mosquitoes, the host of that, the mosquito bites, so that blood meal has DNA that you can track it. And you can tell this mosquito beat this a pig first, then a dog, and so on. That can also be used to track COVID. And I think in Honduras, they were using mosquitoes to track COVID. So basically, there's blood meal in the mosquitoes. And the idea is that they could find animals that would be hard to find, right? So, for example, we were there in one of the reserves, and they had a footprint of a of the danta, tapir. Right, this large mammal is in danger, and everybody was super excited, but they haven't seen it. Right? But a mosquito would find it. So I think certainly for DNA, and mosquitoes may become important to track, essentially in a way to track environmental DNA, assess genetic diversity, but potentially, and with the caveat that, yes, as soon as the mosquito bites, those cells might start to get degraded, but potentially we could also get some cells out of blood-sucking mosquitoes or leeches and so on. So, but it was a project that we could do in that those nine days, and so we have that as a project, as a target project to carry out.
That's pretty cool. But it did remind me, since I think we now have a new Jurassic Park movie.
Right. Yeah. I think I didn't think of that. And actually, the idea of mosquito, maybe it was, I did see that movie early on in my life. So I wasn't thinking. I'm sure I saw that at one point. But the idea of using mosquitoes actually came from the London Zoo Consortium for Biobanks, where they listed bee samples as being in an aphid. So they were counting bee samples as being in the aphid that sucked the blood out of the bees. And that's where the idea for a mosquito came from for our project. Not Jurassic Park, as far as I understand.
Oh my goodness. We had a question. How are you safeguarding the DNA info that would be collected so perhaps it's not used for profit, perhaps?
Right. So the question is whether, how do we make sure it's not used for profit? The I think that's
the basically.
Question. Yeah. Well, the I think that the efforts that we would do would be certainly dedicated to, with the understanding that they're for countries or organizations to use for conservation. This is a technique that. That is there that can be used for conservation genetics, which is hard to imagine how to get it monetized, right? So when we're talking about this kind of technique, we don't expect any kind of monetization. There's always a chance that people use genetic technology and genetic knowledge to monetize. Right now, for example, glowfish is a great example, right? People can make transgenics glowfish or any kind of animal and then sell it. There's not a lot of regulations on that. There, in my opinion, there should be more. But when it comes to preservation of endangered species, what we're doing is non-GMOs, non-gene edited samples that essentially represent the population. Having said that, too, countries like Costa Rica, understandably, they don't want samples, or many other countries, or like Nepal is the same, they don't want samples to be taken necessarily, unless they agree to it, to be taken out of the country, precisely because they put so much effort in their ecosystem to preserve them. And so for them, it's part of their economy as well. And they want to safeguard those from not being taken advantage of, not being exploited. And so that's one reason why we need to work within the guidelines of those countries to respect that and make sure that that any effort it doesn't get inappropriately monetized.
And just to go along with that, there and Paul Robbins is probably could talk even more about this, but the close relationship there is a close relationship being developed with indigenous populations. And could you talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the grant that we are part of now is a large it's a pilot grant, but it's a large group that involves Paul Robbins, who's a principal investigator, and people in philosophy department who are bioethicists, as well as members of Native communities. And we are working with Native nations, trying to have interactions with Native nations or have a dialogue with them to make sure that any, and this is something that's having worldwide. In fact, the pioneers are in New Zealand. And it has also been formalized with the Nagoya Protocol, is the respect of sovereignty of local communities and indigenous communities. And so the idea is that the samples in local indigenous communities' land are belong to those communities, any use or even storage of those samples has to be needs to have a dialogue with those parties which are the main stakeholders.
And I think just for the country as a whole, we've not done this is. In my mind, a good way to go about this, working with the people who are in the particular country or in the particular indigenous population that owns or controls, an area that you want to respect them, and you work hand in glove with those folks.
Exactly.
Yeah. Colleen and Madison called, couldn't stay with us. They have identified a couple of endangered species of trees in Madison. Could this biobanking project help bolster tree populations?
Yeah, biopreservation project we are talking about is with animals because there's a need to start that at a large scale. The tree populations, so there's lots of seed banks, many seed banks around the world. And so the concept of banking seeds is long established there are a lot of efforts for tree. I don't know which specific trees you're talking about, but there's a lot of people on campus and across Wisconsin that would be taking care of that. One thing that we're hoping to do is raise visibility of the animal biobank as much as it would be for a plant biobank. Because generally speaking, when you talk about a plant biobank, everybody agrees, oh, that makes a lot of sense. You preserve mm-hmm. seeds, you prevent strains, you preserve species, native plants, and so on. But then the concept of, and partly it's because it's more natural, because it's sure. perceived as more natural. There's seeds that have that role, and all we do is store those mm-hmm. seeds. But then the animal biobank is something that is harder to understand and less seen in that same context, because even though the methods are different, you may have to freeze them in a different way, the principle is the exact same, the purpose is the exact same, which is to keep those populations healthy, right? So there's a lot of efforts and plans. And as I was saying before, with the corner blue butterfly and the lupine grass, they're integrated too. There's also frogs in Costa Rica that depend a certain kind of bromeliad to lay their eggs and so on. There's lots of examples where those are. So we definitely, one of our goals is to integrate ourselves in the framework of plant biobanks, which are much more long established.
Yeah. And hopefully at some point we'll maybe with Bill Murphy's research be able to freeze dry.
Exactly. This was the goal, is to turn the cells into essentially seeds, and maybe you just can store them in a basement or something, that you don't need liquid nitrogen or anything like that.
And after we're long gone, 100 years from now, those same materials could be brought out and used.
Yeah, exactly. There's also people at the Smithsonian right now working with freeze-dried tissues, and they also can be essentially regenerate into cells that can be used for to create animals.
How many folks on campus at the UW are working on this project?
We have about 40 people, a group of 40 faculty who have been part in the project and various proposals. Actively right now, probably about a dozen that are active in this current proposal, but we had a larger proposal. If we can get this more momentum, we have about 40 people. Because if you think about it, any project that you have field work could be coupled to also a biopreservation project.
And the goal moving forward now, what are the plans here?
Yeah, so we have the pilot is with red foxes and American yeah. martens, and then to use that knowledge with a pipeline that I described, the cell lines, and then also the ethical framework of the responsible use of technology, of the ethical framework of that pilot grant, to expand into a larger grant that potentially there was already a mechanism for a larger grant in that same responsible use of technology, or a center grant, and then just get more momentum for that approach.
It's It's a noble project.
I'm thrilled and honored to be part of it, honestly.
I would bet, and I can tell that you're very enthusiastic and about it, Francisco, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today to talk about it. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for all the callers.
Hopefully we'll get you back and we can, hopefully there's progress down the line and we can come back and talk about it some more.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm sure we have some interesting stories.
And bring Paul back into it as, bring Paul into it as well. Francisco Pellegri is a professor of genetics and is the leader of the UW Biobank Project. It's really fun talking with him about it and interesting. And we'll get him back down the road and we'll find out how things are progressing. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to plants, and in particular, forest plants, the school forest that we have here in Wisconsin. Take a look at the background and history and what's going on with teaching in those forests. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're turning our attention now to Wisconsin's school forest programs. It started, I think it was almost 100 years ago, the forests are used to teach students about conservation and forest management, and the program continues to this day. And she wasn't there in the beginning, but she is there now. Lori Dan's a biology teacher at Superior High School. She is the school forest coordinator for the Superior School District. She was named, as I mentioned earlier, 2023 Wisconsin State Teacher of the Year, which is pretty cool, too. And as we talk about forests, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Were you ever a part of a school forest program? Did you take a class in your school forest, or maybe your kids have or are doing it right now? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Lori Dans, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm laughing because people who know me probably think I have been around since the start of the school forest program, but you are right, I have not been.
Well, you're the coordinator for the Superior School District. What does that mean to be the coordinator?
Well, Larry, I think it's a little different for different school districts, so I can speak to Superior and my role here. What it means for me to be the coordinator of the school district program is basically I organize the lessons we teach. I work to coordinate the trips for the teachers with our transportation department, with our buildings and grounds, with our food service, and I do whatever I can to support our teachers who want to use our site. And in addition, I teach out there, all of the students in our district. So just a little bit of everything.
Well, I don't know how much you know about the history of this, but I found the history of this nearly 100-year-old program to be fascinating. Talk about how it all came about.
Okay, I will share with you what I know, and there may be some listeners out there who know even more, but my understanding is that this program actually started in the early to mid-1920s due to the dean of the College of Agriculture at the University in Madison, Professor Russell, I believe his name is, and there's a building named for him on campus right now. In fact, my daughter might be working there right now. I'm not sure. This was a time we have to remember after the great cutover of our forests, especially in northern Wisconsin. And maybe serendipitously or coincidentally, he visited Australia and saw in Australia some school children replanting trees in Australia. And some light bulbs went on, I'm assuming, where he thought maybe this would be a way where we could, again, replant the trees that we cut down in Wisconsin. And he brought that idea back to Wisconsin. And over the course of maybe the next 2 to 3 years, this was taken up in legislation, and the school forest program began in Wisconsin for that purpose, for school children to actually become stewards of conservation to help replant and care for our forests in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Part of the history that I recall reading about was the fact that the land itself, after the cutover, as you were talking about, people tried to farm the land. And it's not land that's conducive to farming, and they kind of went bust. And it was taken up by the county for tax failure to pay the taxes. And so this was land that reverted back to the counties. So then they had all this property. And then, of course, as Russell came along and really kind of pushed, okay, well, let's use some of this property and plant trees on it, and we can make a school forest out of it.
That's very accurate from what I know, Larry, also. And, you know, in my own family history, I would say that my grandparents were part of that. They have land in northern Wisconsin and tried to farm it. And to this day, you know, you look at photos of the stumps that they had to remove, of the rocks that they had to pick out of the ground. It's amazing that any farming was able to be done. But they learned this was not farmland up here. So,
yeah. And so I think there were three tracts of land originally in Crandon, Wisconsin, Wabino. I forgot the other one. Leona, maybe?
Leona, yep.
Leona. And so those were the first three. And what have we got now? I think we've got, I'm not sure. Do you know the number? I think it's...
Well, the latest number that I have seen on our school forest website is 435 registered school forests. So there are school districts in Wisconsin who have property, I am sure, that are not actually registered with the state, but the latest number that I saw as officially registered school forests is 435.
435, which is pretty good, and that's got to be thousands of acres then, too, obviously.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there are so many different ways to define a school forest. For some districts, it may be, you know, just one, I think it's, I forget which district has the smallest school forest. It's like 1 acre. The largest is in Merrill at 740-some. Superior, we have about 720 acres. So these school forests look very different. And how they're used by school districts is also, I think, different. You know, I can speak to what Superior does if people want to know.
Yeah, oh, for sure. We want to talk about that. There's a... It's not to be confused. School forests aren't to be confused with forest schools.
Thank you for bringing that up, Larry. Thank you. That's absolutely true. When I was traveling around the United States a couple of years ago as one of our state teachers of the year, I was struck. I took for granted that we have these school forests in Wisconsin. And again, people just wanted to know more. What do you mean a school forest? And they often had this image of what we'll call forest schools, which are becoming very popular. The difference I see is a forest school is a school usually that parents will enroll their children in as a full-time outdoor ed school. School forests complement the traditional classroom, so they are a little different. You know, and what I love about the school forest programs is, education doesn't have to be this traditional, sit in a walled classroom. It doesn't have to be fully non-traditional, being outside all of the time. And I think if we can blend those two models of education, it's the best case scenario for our students and teachers in the state. But it is unique. These school forest programs in our state are very unique.
Yeah, they are indeed. And it's not students running out there and planting trees. to make the forest stay.
No. although we do have students who plant trees now and then, but I think the big shift now is this, you know, so many districts, including Superior, and I'll brag a little bit about Superior. Our administration It has been phenomenal about supporting outdoor education. And they see our school forest site as just an extension to our buildings in the city as a place for students to go and learn. So we do teach stewardship of the land. Occasionally students plant trees. But outdoor education is bigger now, and our school forests are encompassing that. We teach everything that a teacher, every subject, every lesson that a teacher can teach in their traditional classroom. We can just move that outside and bring nature into the context of that lesson. And research shows that when we do that, the learning is more relevant to students. And the learning is deeper and stays with them longer.
Let's talk about, these are kind of like outdoor laboratories, I guess you could call them, right?
Right. I like to use the term I always use with our students and teachers is it's our outdoor classroom. So, right, it's a place to learn.
So what do you... teach in the forest? Tell us about you, the kinds of things that you teach.
Well, when you say you, I'm going to broaden that to include all of our teachers in the district.
That sounds good.
Okay, without them, our program would not be what it is, because they have so much ownership in the program. So when we have a group who wants to come out to the forest for the day, we'll start with a discussion of, you know, what are your goals for the day? So for some, it could be building communication and teamwork within their classes. For some, it's specific content. So I don't even know where to start. We teach math lessons, reading and writing. We have our photography classes from the high school out, our orchestra classes from the middle and high school, physics. The message I always try to spread is so many people, I think, hear the term outdoor education and they immediately think science. I'm a science teacher. I love science. I love nature, but our program teaches students learn everything out there. Any lesson that we can teach in the classroom, content-wise, or anything is taught out there.
So give me an example of music. You said the music program winds up out there sometimes.
Right.
What would they be doing?
Every year, our middle school and high school orchestras, they normally don't have a chance to practice together. But during their fall concert, they usually do one piece together where the middle schoolers join the high schoolers. So prior to that concert date, the two teachers usually spend one full day at the forest with both the middle school and high school orchestra. And it's just a way to be away from the main building where they can interact for the day. They practice their music for the concert. When the teachers have breakouts for sectionals, I believe they call them. Being a science person, the music terminology may be a little foreign to me. But during that time, I'll take students aside and we may take a hike. One year, the teachers, we talked about the relationship between music and nature and how many musicians are inspired by nature. The students have a chance to get to know each other and bond. Another visit we had was the middle school choir came out again prior to a concert, and the teacher's main goal, the theme of her concert was Breaking Trail, I believe. And all of the musical selection she had that they had to do with nature and grit. And she wanted her students to experience nature for the day. So we had a day where we talked about the Ice Age Trail, because her students met Emily Ford, who hiked the Ice Age Trail, if you're familiar with that name. And she wanted her students to know what that kind of felt like. So we certainly didn't hike the Ice Age Trail, but we had a very mosquito-laden day. It was hot. The students understood what grit meant being outside. We talk geology, we talk music, we talk perseverance. And I just remember the students walking back to our cabin singing. And it was one of the most beautiful things and most meaningful days of my life. It was so much fun.
I loved it. Lori Dan's our guest today, biology teacher at Superior High School and coordinator of the School Forest Program for the Superior School District. It's great to have her with us, and I hope you'll join in. Maybe you could tell us what's going on in your own school forest. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Somebody else is wondering about math. And physics, for that matter. How is it used? How are those teachers using the forest?
Well, I can give you several examples. For elementary or younger students, there are so many ways that we can incorporate math. One would be patterns, you know, with very young children, just looking for patterns. So it might be as simple as in the fall, gathering oak or maple leaves and looking for a pattern in the color change, where students search for those and look for that. We study symmetry, where you could take a natural object that shows symmetry. And again, that could be a leaf or some other object. And we can cut that object in half and have students draw the other half, again, showing and understanding what symmetry is. With young students, I do a lesson that we call the Math Olympics. And this can be, we can change this for different grade levels, but I'll write story problems. They walk a trail and we'll come to a story problem hanging on a tree or in a bush. And the story problem relates to animals or wildlife that they do. With older students, we can get into some geometry, measuring heights of trees. We can talk circumference. So there's so many ways to integrate math into nature. Fibonacci sequence we can talk about with spirals and things like this. So
how do you get, how have you been able to just develop the kind of broad interest in among your teachers?
You know what, Larry? I think the answer is getting them on site. Teachers from all over seem to have this desire to immerse their students in the natural world. Often they just aren't sure how or where to begin. And what I've learned is there are some teachers who really aren't even comfortable with that setting. And that's where that's something I feel like maybe I can help to provide for them, just being that person who's there to maybe mentor or help. But typically, once teachers come out to the forest and they have a positive day and they see how excited their students were that day about learning, they want to come back. And so part of the role I feel I have is to ensure our teachers have positive days out there also, because if they do it, it naturally translates to the students. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes good sense. The forest itself, now you have 700 acres. That's a lot of property that you're dealing with. I'm wondering, do you have little sections of it managed, or how does the management or the care of the forest, of the school forest?
What's really nice with Wisconsin's school forest program is once you're a registered school forest, Wisconsin forestry departments will work with school districts to plan and help manage your school forest. So part of the idea with the original establishment of school forests was that school districts could also benefit from them. Some school districts will actually earn some sustainable income from doing
forestry logging,
and thank you for that. Yep, management techniques. We earned some money to build two new classrooms on our site about 12 to 15 years ago from a lumber sale. 2 years ago, I had our local forester out and we worked with students. They learned how to go through and survey a forest for management, students who might be interested in pursuing this in the future. So I think one of the greatest resources school districts have is our forestry department in the state to help us with that.
And I think the sort of overall, I don't know if you, management is the right word, but UW Stevens Point was sort of in this back, that goes back to the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, was kind of seated to be the center point for the program itself.
Yes. Yes, and I think they still are.
I believe they still are. What are the biggest problems or challenges, let's put it that way, what are the biggest challenges with a school forest program, do you think?
That's a good question. I would say, when I stepped into this role as our coordinator, one of the first things I did was use the resources that are available from Stevens Point for school districts, one of which is conducting a needs assessment. And it's just a survey tool that you administer to staff and ask them, you know, like, what are some of the issues that you think we have in terms of not being able to utilize our school forest? And from that, the information I received back, and I think this is similar, talking to other school districts in the state, money is always an issue, typically for transportation to the sites. I think other issues would be things like equipment. The thing that came out very loudly in our survey was many didn't feel comfortable teaching in that setting, and they wanted a person who could maybe act as a mentor to help them when they were out at the forest and to guide them a little bit. Many teachers feel they have to be expert naturalists to be out there, and you absolutely don't. You know, like the great benefit of teaching, I think, and learning is teachers ask questions along with the students, and we can always go back and find those answers together. But I think a fear of not knowing an answer to something a student might ask is a little scary for many teachers.
Yeah, I think you need, for a program to be successful, I think we need to have in each of these school forests somebody like you who is enthusiastic. I mean, there needs to be kind of a leadership when it comes to a school forest.
I think it helps. I do. I can speak again for our district, and I think that has really helped grow our program. It really does. And I think a key is both positions, I've taught in the traditional classroom as well as at the forest. And I think the key is just that working together, helping each other. I've learned as much from the teachers who visit the forest as they have learned from me, I think. So it is a teamwork type of thing.
Somebody else wonders, do you use the forest year round? Like, are you out there in the middle of the winter?
Here's what will probably make some people chuckle a little bit. The time of the year that we are not out there is right now in the summer.
Yeah.
although we are right now working in Superior of developing a summer school program for next year, but one of the battles this time of year up here in northern Wisconsin would be the insects, the flies, yeah, the deer flies, mosquitoes. Yeah. But we are very busy in Superior during the winter because of the snow and getting out and snowshoeing and just enjoying that environment too. So yes, we are year round, except minimally in the summer.
Yeah, you'd almost think it'd be the opposite, but it makes really good sense, Lori. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. What you're a great person to be in charge of a program like this. I can see that from talking with you. I appreciate your time very much, and we'll get you back sometime and talk more about them. Thank you.
I would love it, Larry, and I would encourage any people who would like to start a program, reach out to us here in Superior. I'm always happy to talk to people. So thank you for having me on today.
Lori Danz is the biology teacher at Superior High School and the school forest coordinator for the Superior School District. So, and she'd be happy to talk with you some more about it. Great to visit with her. Coming up, another person it's always fun to visit with, Darren Bush. We'll talk paddling in the summer. This is the time of the year, probably for the, in some ways, for the best paddling of the year. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Time to turn our attention to paddling those waters, those creeks and those rivers and those lakes of our state. Who better to talk about it than Darren Bush, owner and chief paddling evangelist for Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. Rutabaga, great to have him with us today. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Do you canoe or kayak? Where are you looking to paddle this summer? What you want some recommendations? Certainly, we have the guy who can answer.
Hopefully.
Darren, welcome.
Well, thank you.
As you listen to Darren talk, do join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. July is kind of considered a prime paddling month in Wisconsin, isn't it? And
well, any month that is one of the 12 months is a paddling month for me. But yes, generally July, the water's warmed up, the air is warm. It's a relatively calm weather, except for, you know, it have the blustery spring or anything like that. So, yeah, it's a great time to paddle.
Yeah, it is indeed. And, you know, that we can talk about precautions and so forth as we go along. But let's talk about some recommendations for paddling to begin with here a little bit. let's just pick the Kickapoo.
Just pick the Kickapoo. You can't go wrong with the Kickapoo. It's one of the oldest river systems in the world. It's 300 million years old, and that's because it wasn't glaciated. So some of the plants and, you know, flora and fauna around there are very rare, if not threatened. And it's pretty cool. And of course, the bluffs are beautiful. My recommendation is to go Tuesday through Friday. Start early. On the weekends, the rentals tend to start clogging things up a little bit. But I go during the week, and I rarely see more than a half a dozen people. And the Ontario section down to Lafarge is generally kept cleaned out quite well. There is as of last week, there was a pretty large log that fell across just downstream of Bridge 12 to 13. So they're working on getting that out of there. But it's a nice 4.5-5 hour paddle from Bridge 1, which is Ontario, down to Bridge 10 or 11, down by Rockton.
There's another little piece, Billings Creek.
Billings Creek, yeah. So Billings Creek is kind of a mini Kickapoo. It's got the same kind of bluffs, but it's smaller. It's a trout stream, so I usually try and be considerate of people that are fishing there. It flows into the Kickapoo just, I think, upstream of Bridge 10. Right in there. So if you want to start up by the ice caves in Kickapoo or in Wildcat Mountain, you can start up there and paddle down. Take a smaller boat.
It's not long, at like 2.5 miles or something.
Yeah, something like that.
But I've heard it described as sort of the condensed version of the Kickapoo.
Yeah, I mean, yes, we call it baby Kickapoo because that's exactly what it is. It's got the same kind of topography, same kind of bluffs, same flora growing on the rocks. It's stunning.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to paddle that.
Yeah, one thing I should point out is I went there with my wife a couple, probably a month ago now, and we were going to do a bike shuttle, which is you drop your bike, drop your stuff off, drive to the end, ride your bike back, lock your bike, paddle to your car, and pick your bike up on the way home. As we were driving back, I went, I want to ride on these hills. That 131 across from Ontario down to Brockton, it's really hilly.
Yeah.
And I just said, no, forget it. So I walked over to Mr. Ducks, which is one of the outfitters there, and said, can you spot my car in Bridge 10? They said, sure, it's $30. Yeah. $30 versus a 10-hour or a 10-mile hilly ride. No thanks. So,
T in Chippewa Falls. I'd have been with you on that. That's $30 well spent. T in Chippewa Falls, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to call and say that if anybody wants to try doing whitewater kayaking or canoeing, that they shouldn't try it alone, and that there are organizations out there that hold classes. So one of the organizations that come to mind is Canoe U and the Rapid Riders. And we're kind of more towards the northern Wisconsin Twin Cities area. But if you want to be knowledgeable and safe while learning how to whitewater kayak or canoe, these folks are the ones to go to.
Yeah, thanks, T. I'm sure you're nodding in agreement there.
Yeah, there's several good folks up north. Also, WASA, the Whitewater Park there, has publicly releases. And if you want to talk about a controlled situation, and I always joke, it's like class three rapids with class one consequences, right? If you flip, you just flush down and it doesn't matter. So that's a great place to learn as well. And we send one of our employees, Dan, is a hardcore whitewater guy. So we send him down almost every weekend from now until September to people can demo boats and just paddle. So it's great.
Chris in Mercer, we'll go to you. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What do you got for us today?
Well, just hello to Darren. Darren, my name is Chris McMurray. I'm up in the Manitowish Waters, Mercer area, and I know that you're going to be up there working with some folks on some paddling, and we're excited to see you up there.
Say hi to Claire for me, will you?
For sure.
The giant loon there.
The giant loon.
Yep.
So, no, I love the topic. I've got a little operation up between Manitowish Waters and Mercer, and we always, one of our favorite routes is either Manitowish River down into the Turtle Flambeau Scenic Waters area or just that Turtle Flambeau area. It's an amazing place. I'm sure you've been there, Darren, but for folks that haven't, it's essentially the boundary waters of Wisconsin, and it's that type of an experience, but it's very, very approachable, a lot of diversity, tons of wildlife.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's I don't recommend usually people go straight to the boundary waters. They usually send Turtle Flambeau, Willow Flowage, or the Bittersweet State Natural Area, because then you can try portaging too. And you're absolutely right. So we're putting on in September Camp Rutabaga. So we've taken over the Manitowish YMCA, Camp Manitowish, and so summer camp for grownups. But we had to stop doing our kayak symposium in Door County because the place burned to the ground. And there was no place up there we could really do it. So I said, well, let's go up here. Trout Lake's 2 miles by 4 miles. That's plenty of place to teach sea kayaking. And then I thought, well, why not let recreational kayakers come? And I thought, why not let canoe people come? So it's across the board just paddling. And what I've found is a lot of people that used to sea kayak are telling me they can't get in their boats easily anymore. And they've switched over to recreational kayaks. And now they can go out and paddle with our community. So that was the main reason for doing it, is just to get the community back together again.
Oh, that's really cool. Chris, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. I've spent a lot of time in Manitowish Waters area, mostly muskie fishing. But I've also spent a lot of time in the Turtle Flambeau.
Good walleye.
Good walleye and good muskie, too,
yep.
Fishing. I can remember, I have one story. I've fished it so many years, I know it pretty well. I mean, about as well as probably anybody can know it. And I saw some canoeists we were fishing, and I was doing a little guiding, actually, and and there were four canoes, and they started furiously paddling toward me. And I said, well, there's somebody that's lost. And I forget, the question was, how do we, I said, how do we get to, I forget where they were headed. And I said, well, what were you told? And they said, well, go out to the round island and then just turn to the right. And I looked around, and there had to be 10 round islands. Oh.
This is like asking for directions in Italy, right? Where do you go? Down the end of the road, there's a tree, turn left of the tree, you'll see a church, go past the church. I'm like, that describes Italy. So
anyway, I was able to get them on their way, but talk about a beautiful, I mean, the Turtle Flambeau Foliage is just a...
It's a great place to get lost if you have to get lost someplace, right?
Oh, man. I've taken people out and speed the boat up a little bit and go around a corner and then say, well, now how do we get back to where we started? Invariably, they'll point in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I get turned 90 degrees a lot, and I don't know why that is. There's something in my head that just turns me 90 degrees, and it makes my wife crack up every time that I do it.
Oh, boy. Again, you can join us, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Call in with your paddling question or comment or maybe experience to share. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking paddling today with Darren Bush, Chief Paddling Evangelist for Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. Again, join in, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. What do you think about the Pine River? Have you done the Pine River near Richland Center?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Pine River is really interesting because it comes into the Wisconsin River at Gotham. And so it's like, let's try and paddle up that. You go up about 100 feet, and it's just trees everywhere. So you think, oh, this isn't paddleable. But if you go up north of Richland Center, just a little bit. I don't remember the exact name of the road. But you can have a nice day paddle. It's a beautiful river.
It's in Richland County. Another one, the Meakin River fishery area near Princeton.
So the river runs between Princeton and Montello, I think. But you go up to the very top, Dixie Road, and even further up from that, it's a trout stream, and it comes down and runs into a fish shocker that keeps the rough fish from going up past there. But it's a beautiful river. It's very much central Wisconsin, lots of fields and meadows and pheasants blowing out of the grass right in front of you because they get spooked. And, you know, baby cranes and all sorts of stuff.
Well, it's a beautiful body of water because I think it's one of the few, there aren't that many places where we have natural reproduction of rainbow trout.
Yep, indeed. That's why the fish shocker is there.
To keep the rough fish from getting into that area. I really think that's pretty cool. Bob in Edgerton has a question. Let's go there. Bob, hi.
Hi. My wife and I and our children and friends have taken a lot of trips on a lot of rivers in Wisconsin over the last many years. And lots of times we go and we look online at USGS gauges about river level to help us decide whether we should go. And I wonder if your guest could comment on how to take that information and what's the best way to look at that that information they use there.
It's a great question. So it's waterdata.usgs.gov. And that will show you a picture of the United States. And what's interesting is it has color-coded dots. So green is like between 25 and 75% percentile. Blue is over to 90. And then black is in flood or close to flood stage. So, and then red and orange are below. So you can kind of squint at it and get an idea where the water is running higher or lower. But then you can click on Wisconsin, and it'll pull up all the gauges. You can click on the gauge, and it'll say, hey, this is how much water is going through. This is, you know, the cubic feet per second. This is your level. If you go, former or current a guest who's on here a lot is Tim Bauer. And Tim Bauer's book and his website both have recommended levels. Like for the Kickapoo, he'll say under 150, you're going to scrape up your boat. 200 to 250 is good. Over 500 is not good. And so that'll help you pick the right level. But yeah, the other thing is it'll show you the median level for the past, some of them for like 50, 60 years. So you can go back and see, well, what's it normally like now? And then there's a little, there's the line, and then there's a triangle underneath that shows the mean. So if the line is above the triangle, it means you probably got enough water to paddle. If it's below, it's a little low, but it's very seasonal.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Appleton called, but then he couldn't stay with us. But he's looking to downsize from a sea kayak. What's a shorter kayak that you would recommend for somebody that's, you know, he's coming from a sea kayak?
I hear this question a lot, and it's mostly because, I mean, people are getting older, and most sea kayaks, they're not light. You know, it's a big, long boat, and they're built to withstand some tough situations. We've seen a lot is people moving to an ABS material. It's, I don't know what it stands for. A chemist can call and tell us. I don't care. But it's a lightweight, think football helmets. It's kind of that kind of plastic. And they're a little more expensive than plastic, but way less expensive than composite. So you can get a really nice 12 to 14 footer that will weigh quite a bit less than your sea kayak. So we're finding that 12 to 14 foot range is probably where our best sellers are right now, is people are moving into smaller boats.
And what would a boat, let's say a 12 footer in made of that material, that ABS material, what would that weigh?
Let's see, 40-ish.
40 pounds?
Know, yeah, 30. I'd say 38 to 45, but most of them are right around 40.
Okay, well, that's manageable for a good share of the population.
Well, some of them go down to 32, 34. So I'm talking about averages. The boats we sell mostly are in the 10 to 12 and a half foot range in that, and they're under 40.
And the composites, they get lighter?
Yes, or heavier. So heavier if they're built for taking out on the Lake Superior, the oceans, and bashing them against rocks. But there are boats that are very, very light, the composite boats. There's carbon fiber boats. You know, we have also, it's called a pack boat. And pack boats are small canoes where you sit in a kayak seat in the bottom and use a double-bladed paddle. So essentially it's a convertible kayak, right, with no top. They're, because they don't have a deck, they can save a lot of weight. And, you know, we have them as low as 19 pounds. And 25, 26 is very, very common.
Wow. So the advantage is obviously weight, but do they have other advantages, those pack boats?
Well, yeah, a lot of people, I mean, pack boats have been around for centuries.
Yeah.
Yeah, they used them in the Adirondacks back, you know, they had their Ford F-250s, which was their Adirondack guideboat, but then they had pack boats for just poking around. And they're easy to load and unload. They're easier to portage. So if you want to go to the Boundary Waters in a kayak, don't. Go to Voyager's in a kayak, right? If you're going to portage, take a canoe. And a pack canoe is basically a kayak without a top on it. And the cool thing is you can get a cloth top that'll snap onto that, and then you have basically a kayak, right? But when you get to the portage, you just throw the bags out, put them on your shoulder, throw the boat up and go. You don't have to try and figure out how to get stuff out of a hatch of a kayak and carry that in the kayak. And it's just, it's not the right craft for that area.
Erin emailed to say her husband is physically limited to probably 2 to 2.5 hours of kayaking at a time, and wonders if you have recommendations for spots near Arborvitae that are good for paddle trips of that length.
Oh, there's so many.
I would
I would stick the lakes. And again, if you go to John Bates' book, it's 50 Wild Lakes. I don't remember the exact name of it, but he's got 50 lakes up in that area, in mostly Oneida and Vilas counties. And I'm going to tell you one of my favorites, which I shouldn't, but I will. It's Frank Lake. Frank Lake is 153 acres. And takes me about an hour and a half to circumnavigate it at slow speeds, trying to see what's there, right? And there's a great story about Frank Lake that I wrote. It's on my Substack, how it was named. It was named for a game warden that died on patrol in the late 30s. And I did a lot of research on him and found out where he was and found his obituary, and I found his great-grandson. So
cool.
It's really cool. So there's a little plaque on Frank Lake that dedicates it to Frank. Frank Long was his name. But it's got a little island on there. You can stop and have lunch. It's these little gems like that that are wonderful. And John's book has a list of all these lakes, and he has specific criteria, like they can't have development around them, right? So, I mean, I like Blueberry Lake. It's 14 acres. It's nothing. But there's blueberries all around it, like right now.
I would say I'm reminded of Black Lake in about 20 miles east of Hayward. And it's in a federal, there's a little campsite on it. It's 150 acres. And there are some campsites, but the folks that are camp there, it's the only building you see. You don't see any buildings,
right? And that's fine. But you know, a lot of those lakes up there around Trout Lake to the east of Trout Lake have campsites on them that you can reserve on, you know, the Wisconsin parks, I think it is, the reservations.gov or whatever, that are paddle in only. And I've only seen one other person in there when I've been paddling up there. So paddle in for half an hour, 45 minutes, set up camp, chill out. You know, they're great campsites.
But I really like your suggestion for Aaron with the John Bates book would be almost perfect for her and her husband.
Yeah, you can pick how much time you spend. And, you know, if he's only limited to two and a half hours, then you paddle for an hour and then turn around, and you know you're going to make it back before he's having any hip or suffering from, you know, from whatever pain he's going to have.
Brock in Madison has a question. Brock, hi.
Hey, Larry and Darren. We're going to Boundary Waters next week. Wondering if you have any updates on recent news on Boundary Waters, fires, wind throw, anything of that sort.
The fire thing changes daily. Yeah. I don't have any. The best thing to do is call the ranger station at either Gunflint or Tufty. But I know the bugs are kind of tough right now. They push back a couple weeks. Usually they're earlier, like late June. But I'm getting reports back because people who live in Illinois stop at the shop on their way home invariably, right? And it's usually to get like a bug shirt or something, right? But yeah, there's a few more bugs. I don't know if that's going to fade in the next couple weeks, but I don't know how it's. I haven't talked to anybody who's been there in about a week, probably.
Okay, yeah, that's a day to day thing.
Yep, and there's been some bad ones already this season early on. As far as I know, most of them were not man-made. They were either lightning strikes or something like that, but there was one that was, and oh, those are tough. You just want to slap them, you know. Put out your campfire, dump water on it. It's like it's out. It's like, no, it's not, you know. Winds come up to 30, 35, it's not out anymore, so please drown your fires.
Please drown your fires. Kathy in Green Bay, do you have a quick comment or question here?
Yes, kudos for the great Winona canoe we purchased with Darren several years ago. And then also question about recommendations for places to canoe near Armstrong Creek or Goodman, Wisconsin.
Where is Goodman, Wisconsin? I don't even know where that is.
It's also near Iron Mountain, Michigan.
Okay, great. Okay, that helps. Well, there's the Border Brule, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. You're not too far from the Bois Brule, so the Brule twins are great. There's some other creeks to your south and west I mean, the Bad Axe can be paddled. As far as that, what county are you in?
Well, Kathy's in Marinette.
In Marinette County. So a little bit more east. The Pine, the Popple, and the, what's the other P one? There's three. just to your east.
We got two out of the three.
Yeah, Pine, Popple, and something else. But those are moving water. Some of them are white water, but most of them are just moving, and you can portage around any class one rapids, but they're beautiful.
And with that, boy, did the time flew. Darren, thank you. We'll do it again, and I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. I always enjoy it. Thank you.
Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports. It's great to have him with us, and also he is one of our many fine business supporters and sponsors, so it's great to have that as well. And great to have you listening in. We've got a number of people on our team, Clara Neiper, Joel Patnaud, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.